Mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world, then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags-to-riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires, many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guests, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this: if you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you.
Hey, welcome to Ditch Digger CEO. Today we've got an awesome guy that we're going to be interviewing here and talking to. He's going to tell his story. But Kevin Cassidy, welcome to Ditch Digger CEO.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm honored.
Cassidy Paving. What the company is, Cassidy Paving, basically, or Cassidy Group? What do you call it?
It's Cassidy Corp, but we go by Cassidy Paving.
All right. Well, you know what? We want to hear your story, Kev. I we had a little pre-talk here, and it's kind of amazing how the similarities we have when it comes to the cool things that you've done, and then how you started your business, and you know the fact that you're a punk kid like me when you jumped into business and you fell in love with this dirty business like I did.
I did. It was the big trucks and the big toys. Yeah.
Exactly.
Not knowing what it really cost.
Yeah. So similarities I'm finding are unbelievable. So, I mean, it's always fun to talk to people that have lived kind of similar experiences. So you're about 20 years younger than me, but, in your 20 year business career, you're kicking butt and having a lot of fun and kind of exactly where I was at your point, three young kids and a great wife, all the things that, we can be blessed with in this great country if we work hard. So let's start out with Kevin Cassidy as a kid in high school and the kind of work you did and why you love this hard work and all that. Okay.
Yeah. So, basically I graduated from high school about 10 miles outside of Boston, Stoneham, Mass, class of 03. And when I was in high school, I had a landscape company, Groundmasters, and, it was one of those things where it was just a want for more. And I realized early that it was beneficial for me to do my own thing, to have the freedom, but to also collect the revenue behind there. And I was very lucky. Both my parents were school teachers, but they never really pushed me into the education side of it. They never said, you have to go to college, you have to do that. It was more like, I think they probably saw something that, in me that I didn't have. Because it's funny, my brothers, I got twin brothers that are also entrepreneurs. They're in a landscape company together. So all three of us went that route when our parents were both school teachers, PhDs.
Wait, none of you went to college?
None of us, no.
Now, see, what I love is you said something. You said that we're lucky. We're lucky. You know, we chose our route and it turned out really well. Well, you're lucky, but your work ethic is... You're blessed that you had the work ethic you had, or it wouldn't have worked out. And somehow your mother and father taught you guys work ethic, because you don't just jump in these businesses and have success unless you're going to work, 100 plus hour weeks. You know, you're going to take some losses, right? You're going to get popped in the chin a few times, right? So tell us about all that.
Yeah. So I had the landscape company, and then one day I watched some guy pave three driveways on my street, and I was like, oh, I can do that. That looks pretty cool. And that, and on top of that, I could never find anybody to fix the asphalt curbs for me in the springtime. So I bought the asphalt curb machine, still landscape. And then it, in I think it was 08, I decided I was going to go into the paving full time. After we bought a few rollers, we started doing some patchwork. And I'm like, all right. So I think that at that point, the landscape company had 10, 15 employees. And I was able to sell that off to another guy who actually still runs it today. And I went into the paving full time. And obviously 08 was not a great time to stop paving. And that was kind of a, gut check at that point, because at up to that point in my life, everything I touched, I'd been successful at. So I had the landscape, I flipped some houses, like everything I did, I was successful at. So it was good at that young age to really take a, take one across the chin in 08 when I was starting, and learn those lessons hard and fast at a young age before I had family at home and all that. And then,
absolutely. And, you know, the thing is that, I started at a time similar to 08. It was the end of the Jimmy Carter world, and interest rates were 18 to 20% for a home. And, you know, things were pretty tough. But I think that when you can start and be successful, and you can start in a tough time and be successful, because you got to knock on doors, man. You got to bust your butt, get up early, get out there ahead of the competition, right? You have so many things you have to do to compete harder in a tough time. Once you understand that, boy, guess what? Tough time comes, you're kind of ready.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the guys in my EO group, which is a business group in Boston, actually nationwide, but he had said to me one time, he's like, it's just getting the reps in. You've got those reps in. You've learned that. You've been through these at different stages. Yeah, the decimal point might be different, and it might have been a $1,000 problem back then. Now it's a $100,000 problem. But at the end of the day, over time, you get these reps in and you learn these lessons.
Absolutely. I can remember, knocking on doors in those first years where, you're trying to pull in $1,800 or $1,000 a day in revenues and make a couple hundred dollars on that, right? Seal coating and patching. And then eventually, you're up to, next you got a goal of 10,000 a day, and you hit 10,000 a day, and that's really cool. You're maybe making, the business itself could be making $1,000 or a couple $1,000 a day, right? And then eventually, the numbers get bigger and bigger, and the reps get to be similar reps, just going after bigger, customers, right? Bigger, you're going after whales that are different. A whale in the beginning was a big driveway, right? A whale today is a big national customer. It's amazing how the work is, like you're saying, putting in the reps is very similar, just, maybe different customers, different target markets, right? But those early lessons will carry through the rest of your life. And we're going to have tough times again, right? We can feel a little bit right now, but. Tell me about back then, 2008, right? Buildings all stopped building, so you weren't doing a lot of new construction, probably. What did you do? Where were you going after to get going and keep people busy?
Well, we started with patching and driveways, and we just kind of continued down that road. But at that point, the lesson was, like, you don't take anything for granted. Like, even at the scale we're at now, like, we don't take any deal for granted. Like, we're happy to have that parking lot. No matter the size, and now we have minimums that it's not the same anymore, but at the same time, the umbrella is still there that you have to appreciate and be blessed for everything that's coming in and be thankful and take care of those people. Like, because at the end of the day, like, you're only as good as your last deal. It's right. If your word's not there and the quality's not there, then the company's junk.
Exactly. So when you think about that, you knock on doors, did you advertise in the Yellow Pages? What did you do to come up with enough work to keep people busy back then?
So yeah, it was a combination of everything. I remember doing Yellow Pages back then. I remember doing flyers that I drop off, job site signs, and just kind of if you see a driveway that was in need and you were doing one down the street, you'd knock on the door. It's a less than desirable term in our industry, but it kind of the gypsy approach where you're down on the ground, boots in there, and, and you're just looking for the next deal. And yeah, it was a combination of all those things.
You could, hey, Kevin, you could say it's a gypsy thing. I was looked upon as a gypsy for the first 15 years, probably in my business, right? You were looked upon as a gypsy also back then. The people, you know, there's that, you know, connotation that there's gypsy pavers out there, and there are, that knock on doors and they say you got leftover asphalt and they're putting a half inch down when it should be a couple inches, and they're getting 50% of the price that you would charge. And they're delivering about 2% of the value. That driveway's going to last for a few weeks, maybe a couple months, right? And then they're ripping it out again. And they thought they saved money. So no, then you know, you looked like that in the beginning, just like I did, right? Knocking on doors, nobody knows your name, right? You're trying to get your name out there, and nobody knows who the heck are you? I've never heard of you. Well, we're kind of new, right?
Yeah.
Wait, aren't you that landscape? I had the same exact thing, by the way. My competition was saying, you want to get that Rabine guy? You know, he's pretty good at landscaping. If you like a landscaper, do your paving, he's a perfect guy. And so, you know, that was the message that my competition used against me on a constant basis. You probably had the same thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We had the local guy saying he has no idea what he's doing. And they were probably right at that point. It probably took a year or so before we got our sea legs under us and figured out what we were doing. I used to have guys that worked for the DPW that used to pave for me in the afternoon. So we had a lead boy.
Wait, what was that? What does that stand for?
So like the local public works.
Yeah.
Well, these guys.
So I don't think we said this, and nobody could probably figure out where you're from when you say parking lot. Okay. But tell them where you're from, what market you guys serve. So where your office is. How the radius you serve and the you know cities and towns you'll serve outside of where your location is.
Yeah, so we're just north of Boston, about 20 miles north of the city, and right now we handle all of New England basically. So about a 200 mile radius of Boston, and we'll travel for stuff sometimes, depending on who the client is. But yeah, we. Nowadays, we're no longer in the residential game anymore. We're in the industrial and municipality side of it. So we're just outside of Boston.
So the equipment you're using now, we talked about this prior, but you know, you guys are using the best technology in the industry. You're using high-tech grade equipment that delivers high production, high quality, right? And when I think about, you're using Caterpillar compactors and Caterpillar equipment, then you're using work in mills, which are the best, and you're using the Weiler pavers, which I think are the best, right? You're using some great equipment, and you know what many people in our industry, or any industry, I think don't realize is if you invest in better technology that allows you to produce better and deliver more quality, it's usually always way worth it if it's not much more, right? If it's 10, 20% more and you can deliver, a similar percentage, 20, 10, 20, 30% more in productivity and better quality, it's a no-brainer, especially when that same equipment probably resells at the same additional price you paid for it,
Yeah.
So,
and we were kind of talking about that ahead of time, ahead of this conversation was what I think a lot of people don't understand because they're not business people, their contractors a lot, is that it's not the price you buy the equipment for. It's what you're going to be able to turn around and sell it for in 2-3 years and what that usage is. So what is that costing to run for the next 4 years? And that's the most important number in the game as I look at it.
I think it's a combination of that and any production gains you can get, right? Because if you can get 10% more production and your daily paving, it's a big amount of money at the end of the year. If let's say you're averaging $20,000 a day and you can average $22,000 or $23,000, just 10-15% more for higher production at the end of the year. If there's 100 working days in a year, that's a few hundred thousand dollars, $200,000-$400,000 spot to the bottom line, right? That'll pay for a lot of equipment upgrades, right? So yeah, I agree 100%. It's what it's going to sell for. It's what it's going to cost you per hour over the course of that life that you're going to use it. If it's a 5-year life, a 6-year life, or a 10-year life, right? So you get that, and other people in, it's just not our industry. Other industries that I also follow and we're part of, it's the same thing. right? What's the best technology in the world that you can invest in? And if you invest in it, how does it pay off? Some cases it could be really expensive and you don't get anything more out of it. No more productivity, you know, not any better quality. And it doesn't get you any more at the resale. So that, in that case, you don't do it, right? That there's technology equipment out there that doesn't really, you know, give you a lot of appreciation and gain, but when there is, buy it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We bought that new mill, a new work in 210 this year, and we demoed it for a month. We had a 4-foot CAD, and when we went to the 7-foot drum, we were cutting a day off of every milling project. And it was like, it wasn't in our budget this year, but it's like, how do you not do that? Because you're seeing that many more tick ups with productivity. It's like, yeah, but a lot of people aren't willing to make that $1 million investment either. So
a lot of money, man. It's a lot of money, and it takes a while to see it come back, right? To see it all come back. But if you know, you have to have a long term vision, right? You can't be short sighted in our businesses. So when you look at competition in your marketplace, how many companies are there that are your size or larger that aren't mainline paving companies? And aren't mainline paving companies, or they don't have asphalt plants, they're not doing highways, let's say, right? How many companies are your size or larger, about, you know, not exactly, but if you said, here are the competitors I'm going after that I have to kick the crap out of in the future. I want to take their market share.
Yeah.
How many are there?
So, it's funny that Massachusetts is kind of broken down into two pieces. The southern half by the Cape is a lot less aggressive. And there's a lot less large scale paving companies. And then north of Boston is probably three or four that are larger size companies that can be aggressive with stuff and are good competitors because we're challenging each other all the time. So everybody's raising the bar. There's just three or four north of the city that are.
So three or four. So there's three or four north of the city and maybe one or two south of the city.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you got four or five competitors out there that are the looked upon as the main and the, you know, main commercial paving companies in the marketplace.
Yep. Absolutely.
So that's pretty common for a marketplace like yours. Our, you know, Chicago for us is, you know, probably double the size when it comes to those 20 million plus, you know, paving companies that are, let's say 16, 18 million in revenues plus, all the way up to $50 million a year paving companies, right? That don't, again, I separate it from the guys that own asphalt plants that are doing mainline paving because we're not really competing with them too often. And you're probably not either.
No.
When you think about, the differentiation that you can deliver, that you focus on delivering to your customer, and because of my opinion, you differentiate or die. If you can't differentiate your business, don't expect it to beat your competition. If you're expecting to beat them in price alone, you're going in the wrong direction, right? You're minimizing your ability to profit and you're undermining the market. But if you can work to make a good profit of 10-15% or whatever that is that you're striving for, and you're gaining in the marketplace because you're great at what you do, you're probably differentiating in some things that you're doing. What are your big strongest differentiators that you focus on to your customers?
So I think what sets us apart is we're always pushing the salespeople to get the quotes out fast. So whatever that customer needs, get them the numbers so they can make their decisions. And then to the next level, so the operation side of it, doing what we say we're going to do. As stupid and simple as that sounds, so many people don't do it. It's like you tell people you're going to be there on Monday, you have crews there on Monday. If you say you're going to do 2 inches, you lay 2 inches. And it's crazy how simple that is, but it's so many people don't do it. And it's like I said, getting them what they need quickly and then executing the job when you say you're going to and doing what you say you're going to. And if there's an issue, dealing with it right away.
I agree. You know, the fast quote thing is something that, you know, we're always fighting because, you know, we end up, we've got all different things going on, tons of opportunity for stuff coming in. And, you know, when we quote things fast, we get a bigger percentage of the work. Just the way it is, right? People like seeing that expeditious response that, you know, when you get a quote back within 2 days or a day, even, right? We, they see that and they say, gosh, these guys perform. And the marketplace is complacent, often complacent, especially in good times. And all of a sudden you're hearing your customers say, you know, these guys told us it'd be 2 weeks just for them to get out and get us a price, or, you know, 3 weeks. I mean, it's crazy what you hear, but if you never get complacent, and then even in the best times, you're quoting fast like that, you're going to have a reputation of, man, these guys, they get on it, man. This Cassidy Corp, they're on top of it. Right. And then, like you said, accountability, you know, after a few jobs with anybody, the customer kind of knows who's accountable and who's not. You earn a trust. The first couple of jobs, they're sticking your pavement. They're doing everything they can to make sure that you're, you know, maybe, right? They're checking on you and all that. Maybe, right? If they are, they're going to find that, you know, you do what you say you're going to do every time. And once you do a few great jobs for somebody, you know, they're comfortable with you because they trust you. And when they trust you, you've got the upper hand. If you're 2, 3, 4, 5% more, oftentimes you're going to say, hey, maybe a few percent more, but it's way worth it to hire Cassidy over somebody else. And we have that, you know, that privilege in our business where our customers that do business with us for any length of time trust us. And I think that the trust is an important thing. But lack of complacency and trust combined, can't beat it. And you will get work if you're just, you know, few, you know, 4 or 5% more, sometimes 10% more than competitors. So
yes.
I agree. And then again, your technology, dude, I'm telling you, in my marketplace and most of the marketplaces I'm in, you're setting yourself apart from the competition already when you have the best technology in the industry. When people see that million dollar milling machine pull up and then, you know, your paving equipment and all the high quality stuff you got, that makes a difference too. You know, I'm confident that's a differentiator in almost every market I'm in. You know, probably the top tier companies in most markets, the top tier, the top two or three have the type of technology you have, and then they drops off after that. So I think that means a lot too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, one other thing I always tell our company is you have to look good to be good. Like we show up, the trucks are clean, the equipment's not leaking all over you. It's like, it's simple, but not a lot of people do it.
Keep it simple, right? That's what we have to think about. So you have to look good to be good. Simple terminology, but it means a lot. Okay, so when you think about, you know, the future, where do you want to be in this business? Let's say 5 years from now and 10 years from now. You think about the future, you know, where could Cassidy Corp go 5 years from now and 10 years from now?
Yeah, it's funny because every time I've done any type of long-term planning, I always miss the mark and we end up overshooting what it was. My first year in business, I think we probably did like 400K, and now we do that in a week. And it's so to see where that was to where we are now, like I never thought we'd eclipse that in 20 years. So like over the next 10, like the growth has been exponential. And painful sometimes too. But over the last few years, I think we've had like 70% growth. So a lot of times you're holding on. And
last 4 years, last 3 years, 70%?
70% over the last 3 years, yeah.
Well, awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah. So so to look forward, I assume that'll slow a little bit. We shoot for 20% a year in the growth market, and we figured out what we can figure out, and then with growth, as you know, there's always stuff you come across that you don't expect for it to happen, and it's learning from that and pulling the right levers to make the following year continue down that path. So in the next 10 years, probably I'm sure double or triple what we are now, because like I said, the decimal point keeps moving. So.
Well, that'll put you at, that'll put you about 50 million in revenues in 5 years. If you have 20% growth per year, right? 20% growth per year in 5 years, you'll grow about 140, 50% larger than you are today.
Yeah.
Right? That's what 20% does compoundingly, right?
Yeah.
And it's, And it's very possible if you, as long as you continue to discover new markets, you know, because again, if we don't know what's ahead. You know, we've had an abundance of you know, growth in our marketplace over the last, you know, 10 years. And we've had this crazy, you know, inflation that also is attributing to some of this, right? Some of this additional revenues. Hopefully it's very little inflation and a lot more just, you know, more opportunity, right?
Yeah. We saw a huge growth when we got out of the residential market because we were able to take those crews and utilize them. Instead of utilizing them on a $10,000 job, we were utilizing them on a $100,000 job.
So yeah.
That was an interesting step for us.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And you feel like you're making more profit on those residential jobs. Maybe if you bid them right, you can make a little more profit. But then when you look at the you know, such a big difference in revenue, small, you know, such a smaller total revenue. So the profit, the opportunity to profit is way less, actually. Even if you're making 20% net profit over the course of the year, you're doing 50% driveways, your opportunities for profit are way lower, right?
That's so cool.
When you look at legacy and all that, how many years you want to be in this business?
It was funny. I was on a podcast about a month ago and they asked me, they said, what's your exit strategy? Cause that's always the entrepreneur's, golden question. And, I said, I thought about it for a second. I said, death. I said, cause right now I like what I do. I don't look at, I might be a sick individual, but I look forward to Mondays. I'm like, oh, we're going to get back in it. We got another week to attack it. And so until that fades away, I don't see myself changing in any way, maybe taking a step back. We have talked about maybe ESOPing in 10 years. I'm 39 now. So in 10 years, I'll be 50. But maybe turning a part of the company into an ESOP and taking some chips off the table that way. But I look at it as a company that I hopefully will be a generational thing.
Cool.
Multi-generational thing.
Yeah. There's so many options. When you can build a great business, there's lots of options, right? You know, I've done kind of the same thing. I've just grown and grown the businesses I'm passionate about. I have grown businesses outside this as well that I've, you know, some I've sold and all that. And there's something to be said for building the business like this, selling it, and then doing it again, right? Doing it in another industry because your name is strong. You know, take your name and do another industry and do it over and over again. Because if you can sell a business like this and for the right number, right, and you know you can take those dollars and reinvest some and put some in a safe place for the future. There's some you said, but I see a lot of people nowadays doing that, right? So in our businesses, it was kind of like it's kind of a lifestyle. It's been for decades, and more lately, there's been private equities groups entering this market, buying companies, and then, you know, flipping them into this bigger conglomerate, right? I think that people like you and businesses like you are going to have an advantage over some of those people because people want to do business with people they like. And oftentimes they don't want to know they're doing business with a public company or a private equities group, right? Where they're not talking to the owner. They can't get a hold of the owner. There is no owner, right? It's a bunch of stockholders, right? And so there's advantages, you know, you and I can take advantage of in you know, keeping these businesses privately held. And then there's advantages to roll-ups too, but, you know, if you love what you do, you'll never work another day in your life. And it's fun to be doing something that you just love. Like you said, you get up a Monday morning and you're ready to go at it. You're excited, right? And not everybody can say that.
So. Yeah. I think I'm in the minority in that department.
So you're going to live to be 110 and 109. You're going to say, honey, you know what? Maybe it's time to sell this thing. You know? Yeah, give it to the kids, babe. Now the kids are 75 years old. Give it to the kids, right? All right. You know, maybe we can do that. We'll sell it to them. We still got time on this earth. We'll sell it to them, right? You're 110. They're 70, 75 years old at the time. And it's time to sell to the kids, right?
It'll be the grandkids.
The grandkids will be buying it. Yeah. No, that's funny. But, and now, and when we look at, when you look at the industry on the whole, you know, do you in your marketplace, in my marketplace, the commercial side, office and retail, is kind of is being hurt in a big way because our taxes are so high in the Illinois and Chicago market. And, you know, we work all over the country, but my home was Illinois. Now it's Florida. In Florida, commercial market, retail market is booming still. In Illinois, in your marketplace, in Massachusetts, I see trouble ahead. In New Jersey, areas where the taxes are so doggone high, the values are dropping in these commercial properties. Occupancy is dropping because businesses are leaving, right? And so I'm seeing a big shift in work being done in those places. Because I have a building in Chicago, Chicago market, that should be worth, it'd be worth $30 million in any market in the country, almost, okay? Almost every market in the country, $30, $40 million value on an office building I have. I'm selling it now for $2 million. I'm going to remain a tenant there. I'm selling it for $2 million, okay? So about 5% of what it costs to build the building, it'd be a $40 million building to build, okay? And so personally, I've kept the parking lot up, the roof up, but most people, if they have a building only worth a couple million dollars, and it's got a $1 million parking lot to repave, they're probably not going to be repaving it. They're going to patch it. They're going to band-aid it, right? Same way with the roof, the facade. So in a marketplace like Chicago, I see it's that retail and office space really being hurt. How what do you look at in your marketplace when it comes to that market and others? Where's the opportunity going to be?
So the one saving grace we have in the Boston market is the education sector is enormous. Colleges, universities, I think I don't know the stat, but I feel like we're one of the leaders in the country with that. So you have a lot of institutional money, in that. I think that boosts up a lot of the Boston real estate, but we're still in the same boat because you have these leftist policies that are just tax, but they got to understand that these people have to make money. If the deals aren't worth it, then people are going to move elsewhere. And I think that's why you see the markets of Florida and like Texas just booming, because it's a business friendly capitalism type of society that breeds that type of growth. And like I said, the only reason why I don't think we're quite seeing it as bad is just because of the institutional
money. Yeah, I can see that. Yep. In Chicago, we have a certain amount of that, but not enough to make a difference. I mean, it's there, but it's not enough to make a difference. We have so much retail, so much office, and the inventory vacancy is crazy. So it's never been this bad. It's only getting worse because they continue to think that tax and spend is their government of choice, and unfortunately, they're killing the golden goose, and yep. So we have to realize that there's some industries we have to watch as you know, business leaders, right? You better pay attention of the politics and regulation that are going in place in your marketplace. Because if you don't, you're going to be caught, you know, still trying to do business with people that aren't there, right? Yep. So,
no, absolutely. And we're seeing a lot of the office, Class A offices flip over to biotech now in Boston. And I feel like that market's almost saturated. But over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen a lot go in that direction. I would say almost a third.
Yeah. So you got some to line up with biotech, huh?
Yeah.
A lot. Yeah. That's, and then, you know, and we don't have much of that in LA either. Okay. So when you look at, when you look at this business of yours, you're going to do it for a long time. You're going to, possibly, you know, do a different type of ownership in the future, participation of teammates and stuff like that. What personally you and your wife and your family, what you're going to do in the future? What do you want to do as far as, you know, the quality of life? This business, you know, hard work enables you to deliver a quality of life to your family and your spouse. What are the fun things you're going to do in your life, or what do you guys do for fun?
So, we're all skiing. So we even got the little guy up on his, skis. He's not great with it yet, but we're almost there. So we do spend a lot of time doing that. I think moving, more into that direction, and I'm lucky now that my job allows the freedom that I can come and go as I please, and and my wife stays at home with our kids, so I'm allowed more freedom with that as well. I think that if there's one thing that stands out, I think we're all skiers and
awesome.
Embrace that lifestyle.
That's an awesome quality of life when you can take those kids skiing and spend that family time with them, isn't it?
Yeah. It's when I got my middle guy and he wanted to come skiing with me and my brothers. I was like, are you good enough yet, buddy? And he was up there and it was the best day. This kid was bombing down the mountain right next to us and he's 7 years old. I'm like, this is pretty cool.
Where's the best ski area out there by you?
So I'm a Vermont. I like Vermont, the Mass. I feel like they got the best conditions around us. So Killington, Stowe, that stuff. But there's great ones in New Hampshire too, Loon. The biggest one's probably Maine, Sunday River.
What's it called?
Sunday River in Maine.
Sunday River?
Yeah. It's about 3 hours out of Boston.
So these are all within a few hours.
Yeah. I actually got a small slope 5 minutes from my house. It's a little 600, 700 footer that we go to two nights a week.
And have you had good snow out there, or is it mostly snowmaking?
It's a lot of, so the stuff real close to Boston is all snowmaking, but everything up north, they've had a real good season. I think they get another 2 feet tomorrow.
Cool. Okay, so think about a couple of things to finish this up. I want you to tell me about your core values, whether they're written and stated or not, and why they work. And then and we'll finish up with leadership. I want to just talk briefly about the value of EO. It sounds like you got to look at YPO next. YPO has been something I've been involved in since I was about your age, and it's a great organization to think about next. So tell me about first core values, and then go into leadership, where you learn leadership from, and what mentorship looks like to you and why it's important.
Yeah, so our core values at Cassidy and mine personally as well are safety first. We win as a team. Results matter. And do what you say you're going to do. And those are all over our building.
Wait, safety first and what?
Safety first. We win as a team.
Yep.
Results matter.
Yep.
And do what you say you're going to do.
Nice. Simple, but boy, if you can live by these, right, you have success.
Yeah.
Yeah. And driving that. So think about how you drive that, Kevin. I mean, tell us about that. How do you drive these core values? I mean, does everybody understand them? Does everybody know them by heart? Do you worry about that? Do you hire by the values, fire by the values? Just into that, go into that briefly.
So I think we've become a lot better at it over the last few years, and the culture itself will allow the people that should be here to stay here, and the ones that don't usually find a way out, or we help them find a new way out. And we definitely hire to it now, and it's something we look towards for everybody coming in the door, especially the safety one. We get almost 600 days without a lost time injury.
Awesome.
6,000 without a recordable. And that's one of the things that I really push. I'm like, listen, most of us are parents here. And at the end of the day, it's not about this, that, or the other thing. It's, do you go home safely to your family at the end of the day? Because we're playing with big stuff that can kill you in a heartbeat.
Yep. Right?
And that has to be the most important thing, first and foremost.
It's our first also, and it should be. Anybody in our industry, it should be first. So yeah. I love it. And to keep it to four core values, I think is invaluable. I mean, we got five, and we're always trying to think about how to get to four. We had six at one point, but either way, short and sweet's best, especially if it really summarizes who you are and who you want to be. I like that. Now tell me about, we believe in mentorship. This podcast, the idea of this podcast is really for people to listen to it and get some mentorship out of it, right? Listening to your story inspires them to think differently, to say, hey, man, that Hillbilly Rabine did it, and that Gypsy Paver Kevin turned into this world-class outfit. I can do it too, right? That's what I want to do. That's all we want to do is, perform, to create some type of mentorship that this podcast is all about. So when you think about you know, I've joined, you know, YPO and other things, national organizations for leadership, and I've gotten a lot out of it. Friends that have done stuff I haven't done that I learned from or whatever. Tell us about like EEO and what you get out of EEO and how it's been for you.
Yeah. So, I had a guy in Boston, Jimmy Kaloudis, that it's a big painting company, $30-40 million painting company. And we became friends. And at one point he said to me,
wait, what kind of painting company?
Industrial painting, fireproofing and flooring.
Okay.
Out of Boston. And, it was probably about 8 years ago, 8 or 10 years ago. And he said, what are you doing to develop yourself? At that point, I didn't really know what that meant. And he said, well, here's what I do. I do EO. I have mentors, this. So again, you come with that contractor mindset. You're like, oh, that's all fucking fugazi. But when you start doing it, you're like, oh, wow, this is, I can put a line through a statement that shows we were at a million, we were at a million two, million three, million four. We were stuck in that $1 million range. I joined EO, I got a couple mentors, and then we started having 30-40% growth year after year. Because I'm a true believer that you're a product of the top five people you spend the most time with.
So absolutely.
That's my Young Forum, and within my forum, I have a range of companies with sales from 10 million to 200 million. So just being around these types of people always pushes me and elevates me. And also they've been through a lot of the problems that I come across at certain points. So you can get that information back. So I think at that point, when he asked me that question, I didn't know what I really needed, but he'd been down that road and he'd seen the natural ladder that you got to take to get there. And so once I started to do that, it stuff took off for me. And, I got a few mentors that I lean on for stuff a lot and I hope I bring them some nuggets of information as well, and I can help them out in some way, but I feel like I get more out of them than they do out of me a lot. So.
Well, you sure do, inspire other people more than you might think. And you're definitely going to be a value to anybody you're around, whether it's being mentored or mentoring yourself. And you'll end up now, this point in your life going forward, you'll end up mentoring a lot more than you're probably going to be mentored, and you'll learn a lot by mentoring. If you reach out to mentor people that need it, you'll understand a lot more than you think about what leadership means, right? When you can see the difference you make in somebody else's life because you shared some nuggets of your experiences, right? It's really, really amazing. And from them, you'll learn things that you've never expected to learn. So. I think mentorship is a big part of our life as leaders. If we don't focus on that and we don't make an effort to mentor and be mentored, we're going to be left in the dust by aggressive entrepreneurs and people that care. So,
yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, all right. And if you ever didn't want to call and talk about stuff, we're in the same industry. I'm here for you. Awesome. I think that, we've lived a similar life for my first 20 years, very similar to your 20 years. And even the kids, I had three kids in 20 years in that period of time, adopted my last son about a year or two older than you. So it's time for you to start thinking about that. Okay. Got involved in politics as far as, a few years later, got involved in supporting good candidates. When I realized what bad politics do to business, got involved in supporting good people that believe in free markets and freedom, and still very involved in that. So that might be, so adoption, if you're going to follow this road, okay, adoption, think about that in the next couple of years, you and your wife will be amazing parents, and your kids will be amazing siblings to one more. Okay. And then look at that, the political thing, not to say you got to get in politics or run for governor or anything like that. Okay. That might be a little crazy, but at least look at how do you support good people in politics that can't be bought. That understand the importance of the Constitution and freedom and free markets, because that's who you are, right? You're building in this amazing country, a great business because we have the blessings of a free market. And if we lose that because we got bozos in leadership positions that are being bought, unfortunately, like I see today at the top of the food chain, we could lose our country and the opportunities of entrepreneurship that you and I love and talk about could be gone. I mean, I think it's that serious, right, Kev? So,
oh, absolutely.
So as you go forward, protect this free market system so that the next generation, your kids and your grandkids, all have the opportunities, because they've got your DNA, all right? And you're going to mentor a lot of people that have this similar mindset, but we want to make sure there's America that allows them to be successful, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was Ben Franklin that said, it's only one generation away from losing it. People get sometimes. Right.
Reagan said the same thing, and they, you know, also Thomas Jefferson, I think, said it's a republic as long as you can keep it, and it's up to us to fight to keep it. So, I do talk about politics a little bit in this podcast, maybe more than most people when they're talking entrepreneur. But if you don't pay attention to government as a leader in business, you're doing yourself, your family, and your teammates an injustice, you know? So,
yeah.
All right, brother. Well, Kevin, thanks for being on Ditch Digger CEO today. God bless you, and keep kicking butt and do what you're doing. Let's keep in touch.
Same to you guys. Absolutely. Take care.
And, well, you know what? Hey, hold on. You know what? I forgot. Chris usually asks a few questions. Chris has a couple takeaways, and we almost cut him out. Chris, jump in, dude.
Yeah, Kevin, thanks so much for your time, man. This is amazing. It's like we've just gone back in time and we're talking to Gary 20 years ago. So, and we've never said that before on the show. So that's...
I'm honored to be in that category.
Yeah.
He's way better in 20 years than I was. And he's going to be way better in the next 20.
I hope so.
We've gone over, so I'll just ask you one last question, and then we'll set you free. I'm always curious to learn from other, you know, wildly successful entrepreneurs, like painful experiences. You mentioned you started with making 400K a year in revenue, and now you're doing 400K in a week, and you're like, there have been a lot of pain during that growth. Can you talk about, like, what's been the most painful part of growing from 400K years to 400K weeks?
Yeah, absolutely. I think learning who the right people are and making sure the right people are in the right seats, and when they're not there, how much that hurts and how much that stunts everything. And then secondly, I think 82% of companies in the U.S. go out of business because of cash flow. And through those jumps in growth, knowing what it costs to grow, because there's an actual money value behind that, and learning those lessons where it's like, oh crap, we have $3 million in receivables, and there's built, like, understanding where that's at, and then putting the financing in place along the way. I think those were, between that and people, were my two most painful lessons along the road up.
Cool.
And still are sometimes. I still have the flashbacks to it in smaller pieces.
Get
hey, Kevin, one more thing I say, ask is, Kevin, when you look at cash flow, you know, some people, you know, in our industry work off of super crazy low margins that really don't even allow them to create enterprise value or really even, you know, pay themselves more than a small salary. You got to build enterprise value for the tough times, right? You got to build equity and retained earnings and all that, right? In my opinion. So yeah. You mentioned an important thing there. And I see people building their businesses or trying to build their businesses on super minimal margins, or they don't even know what their margin is. They think they're making, you know, 20% because it's gross margin, when they're really making nothing because their overhead's 20%, right? So when for our industry and other industries, what is kind of a, you know, goal of net margin, if you go to use that net margin, or you use gross margin or EBITDA, what are kind of your goals that you set forward on a quarterly, annual basis?
We shoot for 37% GP and 13% EBITDA. So,
yeah.
And our expenses are usually, I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, I don't know the dollar value, but.
And you hit your numbers pretty consistently over the years?
We hit them more than we don't. So, yeah.
Okay. So again, that alone, all right, people in our business, for the first 10, 15 years had no goals. Now by about, 15 years, I started understanding how important it was, not just for me to have these goals, similar to what you have, very similar to your goals. I think we're 15% EBITDA, was my goals back then, and 40%. So very, very similar overhead numbers that we're talking about today. We're kind of, our gross margin could be a little smaller because we spread out our overhead over a bigger group of people and revenues revenues and markets. So our overhead's a little less. So, but our net margin goal or EBITDA goal is very similar to yours. But I got to tell you, there's people with way less goals than you're talking about or don't have any goals at all.
Yeah.
They're dangerous to themselves. They're dangerous to their teammates and they're dangerous to the market because, if they do good work, they most likely won't be around in the long run if their goals are, half of these goals that you have. And half of these goals are very common in our space, right? So good job having some goals that are decent goals, right? As far as, your margins, because you will grow enterprise value if you can adhere to those numbers. If you don't, if you drop and you're half of those numbers, you're not creating any value in your business. And even if you don't ever want to sell your business, you always want to make sure that you're gaining enterprise value. And you do that with a decent EBITDA, like 13, 15%, with a decent gross margin of, 35, 40%. So you're right on. So what my takeaways, Chris, in this, the nuggets I got are many here. I've never heard the exit strategy of death, man, death. I'm doing this till I'm dead, okay? I like that because you're going to live a long life because you're excited about doing this. And even if you sell out or do something earlier, you're still gonna be building stuff like this and having fun. But when I look at your core values, awesome core values. Safety first is a no brainer in our industry. Should be the case always, right? Win as a team, awesome. Teams really make a difference. If you get a team atmosphere, family atmosphere that work together, it's awesome. And when it comes to results matter, yeah, absolutely. You better be tracking the results and everything you're doing. And then do what you say. Pretty simple, but not everybody does it, right? So I love all that. I love another takeaway anybody in our industry should have is fast quotes. Get those quotes out fast. So do a good job. Be thorough, right? But minimize the time it takes for a customer to get a quote back and respond fast. Because that type of accountability you mentioned a bunch of times, that type of accountability your customers will enjoy and want to do more business with you. So, awesome stuff, Chris. Did you get any more out of that? But I think I covered a lot of stuff there and enjoyed all this brain dump that we had out of Kevin here.
Yeah. No, you got everything I wrote down, Kevin. Where can our audience find out more about you?
I'm on LinkedIn. I don't know my handle, but Kevin Cassidy Boston, you'll find me. And then our website's www.cassidypaving.com.
All you gotta do is say Kevin Cassidy, the parking lot guy, and then people will know exactly where you're from.
It's amazing. I was at World of Asphalt last week and they picked me out in a second.
I had some guys down there too. They said it was a good event.
So. It was.
All right. Well, hey, awesome having you. Thanks for being here on Ditch Digger CEO, Kevin.
Awesome.
God bless.
Thanks,
you.
Guys.
Keep kicking butt, buddy.
We'll do our best. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
See ya. Thank you.
Bye.
If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at Ditch Digger CEO.
Cans, paper routes, mowing lawns, handstands. Daddy had 6 kids to raise. Factory and not a neighbor heard my name. Learn by example, not the words you say. Watched his every move and followed his footsteps. From a pick and shovel.